Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw, the dog days of summer. At least it's pretty hot where I am right now. Very happy to be doing this episode with Manola Dargis. Hello, Manola.
Hello, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for, I think usually we're kind of frenetically between screenings at Cannes. This is kind of the off season from those seasons.
Yep.
You're actually been taking a vacation, and I thought it was interesting that you were just saying that you don't really, you try to take a break from reading all the movie news as well.
Yeah, no, I'm not paying attention to any of the movie news right now. I'm taking a break from that part of reality. Yeah, so I'm at home on vacation, enjoying, you know, doing chores and things like that. So that's what that's my very exciting vacation right now. But I'll be back pretty soon, and then before I know it, I'll be in Toronto, and then, you know, checking out the new movies for the new season.
Yeah, it all starts again.
In a big rush.
Yeah, definitely. But I guess you have been watching like a couple of movies.
Yeah, I don't take a vacation from watching movies. That's just part of life, is watching movies. So, and my choices are just utterly random, you know. It's like,
yeah, that's the best kind of choice, because it's the utter freedom, just whatever. What do you want to start talking about first?
So I've seen three movies, and it's a completely odd combination of movies, but I've seen three movies in the last, I would say, 5 days for whatever reasons. The most recent one I saw, it's a Bette Davis movie. And my feeling is, I was just thinking about, like, when in doubt, always watch a Bette Davis movie. I've decided that that's kind of like a mantra, because even if it's not a great movie, you're watching Bette Davis.
Yep.
And this is not a great Bette Davis movie, and I don't even know if I even like the performance that much, but it's an interesting one. It's Mr. Skeffington, 1944, directed by Vincent Sherman, who was not exactly... probably is not very well known. I'm trying to think of, like, he made Harriet Craig, which is a movie with Joan Crawford, actually. So he, you know, that. He made Old Acquaintance. That's probably the best known of his movies, with it's kind of women's films. Mr. Skeffington, so it's 1944. It's a wartime movie. And it seems, I don't even know when it's set. I was just kind of going along with it. It's based on a novel of the same name by someone named Elizabeth von Arnim. And I have not committed this to memory. I'm actually just quickly reading this off of Wikipedia. But one of the things, it was written by the Epstein brothers, who, of course, are most famous for writing Casablanca. So, you know, it's quite well done. And it's about a socialite. Everyone's always talking about her beauty. She's Fanny. There's a lot about her beauty, which is kind of interesting, because Davis had a very, if you read any of her memoirs, she talks a lot about not feeling very beautiful and how she was kind of, she had to come to terms with her looks. But by 1944, she's certainly a major star. And World War I is about to happen. So it's early 20th century. And she has all these suitors who are like, Fanny, Fanny, Fanny. And they like all congregate in her, you know, very, very expensive fake mansion. And what happens is her brother has, they're bankrupt. Her brother is George, has bankrupted them, and there's no money. And she ends up marrying George's ex-boss, who's played by Claude Rains. And it's very interesting, because his name is Job Skeffington. So, you know, these are these names that give everything away.
Right. Not going to turn out too well for Job Skeffington.
Yeah, no, you're feeling bad for Job even before he's, you know, opened his mouth. But, you know, once he sees Fanny, it's all over for him. And it's interesting how they deal. He's Jewish, and it's interesting how they deal and don't deal with his identity. Because there are moments when Fanny's brother, the brother is probably somebody who I'm not really familiar with, Richard Waring, comes close to saying something anti-Semitic, but before he voices it, he stops. You know, it's like, I don't like those. And then she says something. So at that point, the production code would have not allowed that kind of overt slander, because it's not a social issue movie in that way. So it's not the point of the movie. But it's how he's coded and everything. It's all very, so he's very nice. He has, he's a very nice man. He kind of rescues Fanny, and she's very mean to him, basically, for a very long time. And at the very end, it's one of these movies. I'm so fascinated by old Hollywood movies that would conform to the production code. You know, fine, but they would kind of go their own way for 95% of the movie, and at the very end, tack on a happy ending. Uh-huh. So that's kind of what happens here. So she's very mean to poor Claude Rains, to poor Job, who suffers, as his name suggests he should. And toward the end, she gets sick, and it quote unquote disfigures her horribly, which means that okay. She looks like she's wearing very, very bad, creepy makeup. So she's no longer the great beauty. But I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil this, and who cares? Yeah. But you know, I mean, really, at this point, I find the prohibition about spoilers completely absurd. But or mostly absurd. Job comes back to her. He's had terrible travails, and she ends up there together, and somehow they are supposed to be in love at the end. And you know, so for the whole movie, she's just flighty and she's terrible to him. And, you know, he obviously is loving her and suffering for his love. And at the very end, there is this completely phony baloney ending. And it's like, roll the credits, yeah. You know. But I just am so fascinated by those movies that had like they had take a certain tone or what, you know. And then mm-hmm. at the very last minute, they completely change. And I think, I don't know about you, but there's certain kind of ideas that when you're first reading film theory and criticism, you know, you read the certain ideas about how movies work, and you read about, you know, movies are subversive, which is, you know, the most overused and ridiculously used word in film, quote unquote, discourse. And since we're talking about Barbie later, we can talk about how subversive that is. Anyway, but you know, how movies actually operate and how you're told they operate don't often align. And so you're told about these happy endings. But the thing is, like, actually, when you're watching them, the happy endings happen, but they happen often so late into the movie, it doesn't in any way negate the first 95% of the movie that you just watched, which is going in one direction and people are, you know, acting in ways that are completely antithetical to the production code. And then at the very last minute, you have this, you know, deus ex machina, and it's like, okay, everything's fine.
Right. It's like this fig leaf or something.
Yeah, it is a fig leaf, but because it happens so late, it just like the whole emotional, psychological kind of weight of the movie cannot be righted, or so-called. Mm. You know, it can't. And so the movie has actually effectively done these interesting things. And then at the end, it's like, I'm sorry, you can't, you're basically tying a nice little ribbon on a big pile of, you know, a mess, and a kind of interesting mess or something horrible, but it's like, it's all fine in the end. Yeah. It's like out of the past, you know, is like, I think like often certain noirs are better examples, because like out of the past has this very, you know, kind of sexy and dangerous love affair at the end, and the main lovers die. And at the very end, you know, our heroine, who's lost the love of her life, played by Robert Mitchum, goes off with a really boring guy. And you're like, that's a very unhappy ending. I don't care how much they try to tie a little bow on that. It's like, you know, for most of the movie, you've been watching this very hot and dangerous love affair. And it's like, oh, they're dead. And now we're going to have this little, like, it's almost like a coda, you know, but it's actually the end of the movie. It's just, it's so funny to me about how there's, and that, you know, you'll read about how movies are supposed to be working on you, and you're like, you know, it's not quite working the way that you're saying. It's actually quite disturbing, and that little happy ending is actually making it all the more disturbing. So Bette Davis is, you know, as always, incredibly watchable. She's affecting this very weird voice. It's kind of at a higher register. And she's, you know, she's playing this flighty, vain, much pursued socialite, and the hair that she's given and the costumes are not very flattering. You know, it's just it's Warner Brothers. They're not it's not MGM. Let's put it that way. You know, so it's not quite the top flight. You know, kind of. I was thinking like what she would have been styled like if she'd been at MGM. So you just keep hearing about like how amazing she is, and she's the top, and you can just feel the artificiality of the whole conceit in Davis's voice, but it's still interesting. And, you know, she's as mesmerizing as ever. So
I wasn't able to watch the whole movie, but I did watch the trailer because the older trailers are often kind of funny.
Amazing.
They did just lay it on so thick, and it's great. Mm-hmm. I mean, every decade of trailer lays it on thick in a different way, but then it was really playing up the studio. Like there was, you know, maybe a little bit of insecurity or something. It's like only Warner Brothers could do this. You know, the book of the year becomes the film of the year, you know, these sort of things.
Right. And a lot of exclamation points. Old trailers always had like at least one, sometimes two exclamation points. And the way they would use, I'm not sure what the actual technical term is, and it's embarrassing that I don't know. It there kind of looks like flipped cards, you know, how one frame changes. It's almost like a flipped card. You know, the greatest story ever told in widescreen with Betty Davis. Except this is not widescreen. It's not the greatest story told. It's just Betty Davis. So it's, and it's also got this, you know, very heavy duty, kind of typical Francois Waxman score. But I love, you know, one of the nice things about watching old studio movies is that even if the movie is not a great movie, you know, there's a certain technical competence that you're guaranteed that is always very pleasurable, particularly when compared to today.
Yeah,
I know it's going to be in focus and it's going to be framed nicely and there's going to be actual staging. There's going to be staging and camera movement and it just won't be single shots of, you know, talking heads. So, you know, it wasn't made for television, which brings its own pleasures.
Yeah, it's funny. I've had that kind of conversation with people saying that about like movies from the 90s, you know, like, you know, you'll watch like a comedy from the 90s and it'll be, you know, I mean, it might as well be the Wizard of Oz in terms of, you know, just like even just the colors or something or but I guess that's just a shift that's happened on a number of fronts. I mean, also I think something else I always noticed just is framing. I mean, the idea of framing just at some point seemed to just disappear. I mean, I know I'm exaggerating here, but it just, the idea that the camera is capturing like a rectangle frame that you would arrange things in at some point became a much lower priority. And I don't know if that had to do with like digital cameras or dynamic camera work or something. But even within those type of films, it doesn't, the idea of a frame goes away. It's weird.
I mean, you're particularly aware of framing and I would say staging, you know, with Academy ratio, because you're really often, you're looking at this boxing. It's just so interesting to see how beautifully people are arranged within the frame, right? And I mean, I actually think that, I mean, obviously, I think good filmmakers are attentive to these kinds of things, and that is part of the reason. I mean, I think one of my biggest beefs is, which is a weird idiom to use if for a vegetarian, I just realized. Anyway, but one of my biggest complaints is that there is not this kind of coordination between staging and camera movement. I think there's so much kind of attention paid to camera, like, and the camera person is just doing whatever, often, you know, not necessarily handheld, so it's not shaky cam, but you know, the camera's mounted on the shoulder, whatever, and there's a lot of movement, so the camera is doing a lot of the work, right, a lot of the heavy lifting. And a lot of times what you're really getting are these single shots, right? So you're cutting back and forth between two heads talking. So it's exciting when you see somebody who actually is attentive to all of these things, you know. So like Wes Anderson in Asteroid City, like it was just so pleasurable because he also plays with different aspect ratios, but within the frame you can see actual intelligence at work. You know, this is someone who's actually making meaning as well within the frame, with in terms of staging and how the staging complements the camera work. I mean, the whole thing is just
It's and that one too, even just the colors, I feel like I'm gonna
oh my god, I don't understand. I want to read about the colors, but I, you know, I've been taking a little bit of a break, so framing, and then what's, you know, how is the frame framing the world, you know, as it were, like what are you actually being asked? And then within the frame, like how are people moving? How is the camera moving with the characters and other things that are happening, you know, traffic, whatever. Like, I just feel like there's such an inattention to all of these things. And it's just the concentration on big talking heads has just been so incredibly dispiriting, you know?
Yeah, no, it's true. And actually I was just thinking of a 90s movie that I just saw where I had this feeling like, oh God, this is only like 20 years old. But and it was, of all things, Ronin.
Oh yeah. With Robert De Niro.
Yeah. It was part of a Robert De Niro collection on a plane I was just on. but even in the plane, and maybe especially because it was a plane, you know, that tiny square, I could see how much care.
But I mean, it's Frankenheimer, and I would expect that there would be a lot. I mean, that's part of why that movie, which is not super memorable, but it's like Frankenheimer was, you know, Frankenheimer.
And I mean, because like the first, there's almost like 45 minutes in the beginning where he's just arranging and rearranging this team of like rogues of Ronin in a room, and you see how he's fitting them in. And that continues throughout the movie, where he's like using this deep staging for all these different like altitudes within a city. I guess it's Nice where they're going to at one point. And yeah, I was like, yeah, I just don't see that as much. And now I'm trying.
And he knows what to do with a big head. Let me just say. right. Frankenheimer knows what to do with a big head. You know, it's not just some boring head in the frame. This head, depending on how he shoots it, is just like menacing, you know, whatever. I mean, this is somebody who actually knows what to do with heads as opposed to just like, here's a bunch of heads, kind of yammering away.
Yeah, it's true. And some good car chases in that one as well.
Oh my gosh, I remember that. That actually, I think I want to watch that again. Yeah. Thanks for the tip. Yeah.
Well, it's also one of these like 90s action movies where like you can feel them raiding the screenplay drawer for like, who's the villain? You know, what is happening? And I think he kind of wisely settles on the idea that it's just this post-Cold War chaos and just pushes that to the absolute limit. So everyone's like, there's all this double crossing going on. So yeah, it was kind of interesting.
Oh, good.
Anyway, that reminds me that I caught up with Mission Impossible, which I think you were a fan of, right? The latest.
I was, you know, I mean, it's a genre movie that's not a slight, that's a description, you know? And so, and it's interesting, I think there's quite a bit of variation within these movies, but I think that Tom Cruise feels very comfortable with Christopher McQuarrie. Mm. Like, so I feel like there's a level where he just has brought out some kind of, Tom Cruise is not what you would call a relaxed performer. Let us, you know, cue the laughter there. He's a very uptight performer. And even when he's kind of playing someone who's supposed to be more relaxed, like you just always feel him kind of working, you know, like the guy is just the hardest working man in show business in some ways, you know, and there's a kind of tenseness that really never dissipates, or I can't think of anything right now that would actually fit the bill. But there's a kind of playfulness that has kind of entered the series, which is actually nice. And I think it's actually a good thing given that Cruise is now over age 60, you know, and he's still doing these completely, you know, insane stunts that you just think, my dude, why?
You know, like, you can take a break.
It's like, no, but it's, you know, I do find it fascinating, you know, and I think it's obviously got some sort of great psychological element to it that I'm not really terribly interested in finding out why Tom Cruise does this, but it is interesting. And it's interesting as someone who's written a lot about Tom Cruise over the years to kind of watch how he's changed over the years, you know, and he just feels there's a playfulness in this movie that I really, really enjoyed, you know, and it has some really excellent stunt and action scenes that, so I'm a very, I think, you know, I'm very, very keen on action and stunt work. And I thought this had some most excellent car chases.
Oh yeah.
Among other things.
One of those movies where they successfully like roll one stunt into the next, you know, so
absolutely.
And which creates this kind of delirium that is like on top of the action itself. I'm just, you know, it's just kind of a delirious experience watching it from one to the next. And yeah, I mean, he's always running. He's the running man of cinema.
He is the running man of cinema. Today's running man of cinema. And he's got a really interesting run. Actually, this is kind of like rabbit holes that I go down when I'm reviewing. And it's for whatever reason, I was thinking about Tom Cruise as a runner. Mm-hmm. And he has a very interesting run because he runs – he doesn't, I don't know, Nick, have you ever been a runner in your life?
I jog for health reasons.
Yes, I would say that I probably have never, nothing I've done has ever qualified as real running. I think I would call
I run to screenings. I do that.
Jogging. Yeah. And I think you've seen me running to screenings. Probably not. I run fastest when I'm in, I think like usually people see me, they see me running to a screening. So jogging, and I used to run all the time, years ago. And so I'm very interested in how he holds his upper body almost straight up, like it's a vertical. He's not in any way pushing forward. You know, his body is very straight. Mm. And his arms, what he does with his arms and his hands. So because it's Tom Cruise, there's been actually stories written about his running technique and having professional, like a couple sports sites actually even talked about his running technique with like real runners, you know, and like,
yeah,
he's got a good technique. He's very good. He's very, very good. And there's something kind of weird, like to my eye, kind of strange what he does with his hands. I think it's just the way he holds his hand. I'm sorry. More than a month since I've seen it.
Well, it's like a dash. It's kind of a 100 meter dash thing where he's trying to, using every single swing in a way.
Right. But he's not swinging too hard, actually.
Oh, really?
Look at his, like, he's, if there's a way that he holds his arm. I mean, Nick, we need to get into the nitty gritty of Tom Cruise's running style. You know, it's a very vertical kind of the way he's holding his body, and you know, gestural physical performance is all part of a performance. And so it's always interesting to think about these things. So I also like to go down these ridiculous rabbit holes, partly to procrastinate, but.
No, definitely. When I saw this Mission Impossible and his running, I flashed back to the Bourne movies when mm-hmm. Matt Damon, because he was doing that kind mm-hmm. of running, but mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. true. If I think of Matt Damon's running, there's something more like touch football about it. Not in a bad way, but just the way he's oriented is different than Cruise's.
Yeah, and he's built differently too. You know, he seems a little bit more compact and maybe a little bit bigger, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not about Cruise's height. It's about no matter how fit he is, he always has quite a slender profile. And I mean, that's part of like the pleasure of the first Mission Impossible movie. You know, I was thinking about the things that I really loved about the first movie, which at the time, I'm sure I was completely contemptuous that Brian De Palma was making it, but like now I'm like, it's a classic. That the physicality of the actor, not just the beauty of the actor and how the actor looks, but the physicality and what they're doing with their bodies is also part of performance. And I think this is where, you know, we have to, whatever one thinks of Tom Cruise's off-screen life, how he represents on screen is interesting, you know, and the absolutely wonderful, very famous scene in the first Mission Impossible when he is lowered down by a rope and then the rope slides down and he's hovering mm-hmm. almost perfectly horizontally. You know, that's such an incredibly pleasurable moment. And part of it is just literally the chromatics of it. Like he's wearing all black in this all white, very, very bright white light room, right? Very, very bright, almost glowing white room. And then, you know, De Palma then has the overhead shot that, you know, so you see it looks like he's about to enter a spider web, you know? So it's all that he is the spider on this web.
Yeah.
But not everybody can do that, you know? I think maybe give enough attention. We're more impressed by accents, let's say, than we are by the fact of if someone is really good at doing stunts, you know, and I think that's silly.
Yeah.
You know, they're both part of the performance and each should be respected and honored and discussed.
Wasn't there for a while, maybe there still is, a kind of movement to have one of the Academy Awards, a technical award for stunt work? I don't know if that.
Absolutely. And it's absurd, particularly, I mean, I think, and it's, you know, the whole stunt world is super interesting in part because there are these companies where, you know, you basically are outsourcing the stunt work, you know, and some stunt people, coordinators have their own companies and they'll design an entire stunt and sometimes action, including like car chases and things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you watch a car chase that is using real cars, you know, it's like, compare that to just like one of the Fast and Furious movies, you know, those movies have their own pleasures is the word I'm not sure I'm going to use very freely with that, but you know, they have their amusements certainly, but most of that stuff is CGI, you know, and it's very different in how it really registers when you're watching a real car kind of go through the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, no, I did. The only thing that I started that kind of would take me out of it occasionally is just this sense that action movies, I guess maybe especially Mission Impossible, because they're often predicated on someone like directing him. I thought of it as the Google Mapsification of action movies, where the action hero is being told where to go, like through someone else who's like their GPS guide, and somehow it's like, well, whatever happened to the days when the hero had to just find their own way on the ground, and you know, I don't
pull out a map, right. And then we would have like maybe a little toy airplane going across. That brings us back to Wes Anderson, you know, going across a physical map. It's true. There's, everyone has an earpiece and they're being barked instructions. Go right, go left. Okay. Yeah. So that's a very big part of the whole Mission Impossible world.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, in Ronin, they have a guy who is doing the same thing, but because it's 1998, it's a guy who has an entire truck to do all of that.
Oh, right.
Well, let me see. Let me see if I can find a connection to another movie you saw. And I guess what I would say is, if we were talking about like the very gestural, you know, action movie running, I think the star of another movie you saw is kind of a genius of conveying like interior states and thinking on screen. Another aspect of the performance, and that's Night Moves.
And it's funny, I just watched it again. I've seen this movie like maybe 5-6 times. I love it. And I have watched it in the last year, actually. And I don't know, I think it was one of those things where it was the end of the day. I was waiting for my husband to come home, and I have this like little pocket where I'm done doing whatever I've been doing, and now I just want to watch something. And so I had watched all the crappy television shows that I watch, and I kind of run through all those and some good TV. And then it's one of like, you're searching for something and you're like, oh my God, I reviewed this. Oh no. You know, I'm just like clicking and, you know, poor pitiful movie critic. You know, I've seen everything. I certainly don't want to revisit most of the things I've reviewed. And it just like landed for some reason. Night Moves just kind of popped up. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to rewatch that movie because it gives me so much pleasure. And this is a 1975 movie. I mean, Wikipedia calls it a neo-noir, which I'm like, yeah, whatever. But it's a, you know, it's a drama directed by the great Arthur Penn and stars Gene Hackman as a private detective who's hired to look for a missing teenager played by the very young and really, really good Melanie Griffith. Quite wonderful. Yeah, she's so great in this movie. And it's really wonderfully cast. Jennifer Warren's in it, Susan Clark, and a quite young and sleazy, kind of perfectly so sleazy, James Woods. Anyway, he plays Harry Mosby. He had been a football player, and his personal life, I'm not going to talk about too many of the details because listeners have not seen this movie, it is one of the great movies from the 1970s. Absolutely. You know, when we talk about the 70s as a very fetishized era, this is one of the reasons that the fetish exists, you know. So he plays a detective and he's hired by this retired kind of movie, I'm not sure she was a movie star, but movie actress, who's really kind of a grotesque character, to find a daughter played by Melanie Griffith. And it's the kind of the rabbit hole that this takes him down, which becomes progressively darker and more despairing. And it's just a really, really tremendous movie. And yeah, you were just talking about, I mean, one of my favorite actors by far is Gene Hackman. I think that he is a tremendous actor who can do almost anything. Yeah. And, you know, he's been retired for a while. Now I believe he's in his 90s, and I hope he keeps on going for a while longer. And, you know, it's funny because I had been also watching Unforgiven not too long ago. Oh, wow. And I was just thinking about how Hackman, and also just thinking about Hackman because, of course, William Friedkin just died. Yes. And Hackman's, one of Hackman's kind of first big important roles was playing Popeye Doyle in Friedkin's The French Connection, which is by far Friedkin's best movie. I don't care what anyone else says, but that is just that's just a fact.
I think I would agree. Yeah.
And, you know, you watch The French Connection and other Hackman movies, and like particularly like Unforgiven is another example. Hackman does not care if you like him. I mean, that is just, I think that that's really interesting. And it makes for a really interesting, and it's part of what I think is like gives his performances this little edge. He's not a beautiful man, so maybe he doesn't have the beautiful man's desire to charm and seduce, or the beautiful man's kind of, I don't care what you think about me, but, you know, Hackman is just playing the role. And if he's playing a jerk, Hackman is one of the most comfortable actors playing assholes ever. I mean, he's just like amazingly great. And so, for instance, in Unforgiven, he is playing an unspeakable sadist, you know, yeah. And there is just no point in that movie where he asks for your love, you know, where he asks for the viewer's love. That's really interesting. And I think that that's really difficult. I think even when actors are playing, most actors are playing villains, there's always this little thing, you know, they don't want you to really hate them. I may be just full of shit here, but no, I kind of always believe this, you know.
Also that if they are a villain, they're going to make you want to like them as a villain, that they're kind of like.
Exactly.
They'll like you as a sadist.
Yes. They want to prove the I think they try to humanize the villain because they want to. But the thing is, Hackman knows that the great performance that he is giving is going to provide all the humanity, and people are awful. So, you know, why? So he does these, like, you believe his villains, you know? So in Unforgiven, you absolutely believe that this guy is a sick, sick sadist.
Yeah.
And French Connection, you know, Popeye Doyle just like throws people around who, you know, he's trying to get information. There's a famous scene, he's in a bar and he's just like harassing all the, and he's racist, and he's just a, you know, really pretty kind of foul, bad, he's not the cop of Law and Order, shall we say, you know what right. I mean? We're always like, always good cops, you know, it's like, it's a very, and he's like kind of sweaty and coarse and he doesn't look great. Like, I think, you know, we have this transition in 1970s cinema where you have different actors starting to play these characters that aren't necessarily, you know, they're letting it all hang out, you know, with the, like it's hot. It was just Dustin Hoffman's birthday. So, you know, he was all over. I always have a heart attack when someone is trending because I'm like, oh my God, did they die? So, Dustin Hoffman was trending because it was his birthday. And there were these little clips from Midnight Cowboy and plays, of course, famously Rats Rizzo. And it's just a, you know, he is so comfortable getting into that really pathetic, you know, character.
Yeah.
And that character is a little, is obviously sentimentalized, I would say, you know, certainly by the ending. But I think, you know, he's not afraid of looking like a character named Ratso Rizzo. You know?
Yeah.
So Hackman, you know, Hackman is just one of these actors. You can see the thought processes. You know, there is a way that he can transmit thought through his performance, through his silences, how he, the watchfulness of his eyes. And there's just this absolute, you know, you often hear one of the cliches is that actors give these committed performances, which I never understand what that means. It's like, it's like, really? You think this person didn't want to be committed to this performance? Like, you know, actors are trying to commit, but it's like, can they do this? And Hackman, I think, can. And a movie I don't even fully love, but I think he's amazing in, is the Birdcage movie. Yeah, I think it's just the Birdcage. And Hackman plays the father of one of the characters who's getting married. And he's just amazing. He's so, there's one point where he shows up in drag and he's just having a blast, you know, he's just wonderful. There is a fullness to, a richness to his work that is, acting is like directing. You can kind of work your way around it and try to understand what's good and what's bad, you know, and you can kind of talk about someone's visual style and they're very good with actors, but what does that addiction even mean? You know, I mean, there's, so there's always this kind of mystery to me a little bit. And I think it's the human factor, right? It's like Hackman has this kind of extra thing where he is just absolutely giving the performance that needs to happen. I mean, think about The Conversation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is such a crabbed and in kind of withdrawn performance that is not, does not have a lot of tells, you know, it's not giving away a lot to you. And so you're kind of really on the outside and you're just trying to figure out what makes this character tick. And it, so it's really interesting to think about how Hackman can really be withholding, but then let everything kind of hang out the way he does with Popeye Doyle in The French Connection.
Yeah.
Just an absolutely fantastic actor.
Yeah. I mean, and that movie just, I feel like he can do so much, even just like talking under his breath to a certain extent. You know, there's something about Hackman.
Yeah.
And, but at the same time, he transmits a kind of glee about the particular character he's playing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's an energy.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a great deal of energy. I mean, there are some performances that, you know, it's not really his fault that performances aren't as good as they could be. But that is really, I mean, he's great in even just, you know, something like a you know, playing a supporting role in Bonnie and Clyde. Mm-hmm. He's very, very memorable in that movie. He really, really pops out. So, yeah. You know, and I love him in Royal Tannenbaums. I mean, okay. He can, this is someone who can do, play incredibly vicious villains and then just absolutely make that transition to, you know, beautiful comedy. I just, it's quite remarkable.
I went back and read this long interview with him, which I guess was around the time of Mississippi Burning. Is that right?
Oh yeah. Truly terrible movie, but yes, they're both very good in it. Yeah.
And he was talking about, well, he was, I guess, in the same acting class as Dustin Hoffman was. And, mm-hmm. And, but also that he was going to make his directorial debut with The Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that. What an interesting little tidbit. How fascinating.
Yeah. And I don't know what happened on the way to doing that, but yeah, that was really interesting. And yeah. And there's also, I don't know, a kind of meta respect I have where he just sort of decided to stop acting at a certain point. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess he wrote historical novels maybe or something like that.
I think he did. Yeah. I mean, if you want to just like a further proof of his greatness is he's a great Lex Luthor. I mean, he's absolutely
so much fun.
He's absolutely fantastic in the Superman movies as Lex Luthor because, and it's like two notches from full on camp, you know, like, but he keeps it controlled. So it's just this very eccentric character. and you completely buy him. You know, it doesn't make any sense that, you know, the guy who's from The Conversation is doing this. But he can, you know, he's very good at interiority, but also at externalizing a character through all sorts of different ways, you know, gesturally, how he looks, how he smiles, all of this, you know, how he moves. And he, you know, he changes his body really not, I don't mean in terms of the kind of boring stuff where people gain 40 pounds and that kind of stuff. Like, that's not really interesting to me. That often, unfortunately, feels like a gimmick. But just in terms of like how he walks, mm-hmm. how he presents, physicality, you know, it's he's a remarkable, remarkable, remarkable actor.
Yeah.
So that was really part of it. But then, you know, Arthur Penn, good director. So that was really, I mean, all the performances in Night Moves are top notch. Really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now you're making me want to see. It's been too long since I last.
It will make you happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I last saw it at Anthology or something, which was like, mm-hmm. happened to be the perfect place to watch it, because for whatever reason, it was like five people in the audience and it was just this kind of cavernous. So it made the like kind of, you know, desolation feeling of it all.
Which is actually kind of perfect for a movie that's very much about alienation and
alienation. Yeah, that's the word. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So the Night Moves, and I mean, yeah, for me, my like movie that I end up watching probably more than I should is All the President's Men, also a 70s movie.
Terrific movie. Absolutely terrific. Absolutely terrific.
I think maybe something about the past few years has, you know, kind of created a need for that kind of resolution, that kind of.
But I also think these movies are kind of like the adult version of The Wizard of Oz, because I've seen The Wizard of Oz more times than any movie I've ever seen, just because it was on television when I was growing up. I'm one of those people who, we had a black and white TV very, very late, so well into the 70s. And so I didn't know about the whole color transition until I was an adult. Oh, wow. And boy, was I surprised. So I was like, whoa, that was quite a shock.
Where did you see it for the first time in color?
It may have been on color television, actually. Okay. You know? Yeah, we had in college and I was like, oh.
That's amazing.
So yeah, kind of wild. But so I think like All the President's Men is kind of like my adult version. Mm. Like there are certain movies, like I would say The Godfather is like the movie that I will, if it's on, I will watch it. You know, like if I just have to be like looking for something, yeah. And it, you know, because I got rid of my, I basically just have Odious streaming now. So I don't, the chances of like just kind of running across it, like the old days where you would just, you know, kind of channel surfing and then The Godfather would be there and I'd be like, suddenly, you know, an hour and a half later, I'm still watching The Godfather because you're just brought in. You're like Michael, they bring me back in, you know? Yeah. So there are certain movies where I'll just like, oh yeah, I'll watch that again because the movie just offers so much that you can go back to it again and again. And All the President's Men is just so good. Yeah. It is such a great movie. So
yeah, yeah. Just gonna say about TV, I mean, that is something that I kind of miss since I do end up watching more things on streaming services. Yeah. It's just the serendipity of finding things. And so sometimes I'll turn on, there's a station called Movies!
Don't know.
And
I don't know.
It is just an old kind of like old movie channel. So I'll just check out what's on.
So you still have cable then, right? You have
it's through an HD antenna.
I see. So, okay. Yeah. I have an antenna that I drag out. It's very light.
For the Oscars.
Yeah. So once a year I take it out of a drawer and I stick it on my window, you know, and pick up a signal from Mount Wilson here and watch the Oscars and hope that, you know, it doesn't freeze up. That's how I do it. Otherwise it's just, I'm constantly turning streaming services on and off like a water tap because, you know, once you've gone through one, you know, you've gone through the season of something that you like. It's a complete waste of money to stick with most of these streaming services. They're completely terrible. And you know, the money adds up. It's like, I think we're paying almost as much.
Oh yeah.
You know, when you start realizing that you forgot to turn off Apple, forgot to turn off Hulu, forgot to turn off HBO, like fucking Netflix, you know, whatever. It's just, it adds up.
It really does, you know, because I mean, I always remember how the cable bill would kind of steadily creep up and I'm like, what am I paying for? Mm-hmm. Now it's just, the combination of different streams. And now there are like other reasons where I'm feeling I don't want to be giving money to streamers.
Well, exactly right. You know, so, I mean, I canceled the Netflix. I canceled my Netflix. I barely watch Netflix, but so it wasn't like a big gesture, but I canceled it when the strike started because I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like my little pathetic support. The thing is, like, I think when it, like, most of these streamers, like, you buy the movies and then you feel kind of like, oh, damn, it's not very good, but you've already spent $3 on it. Mm. So you kind of like,
yeah.
Oh, whatever, I'll watch the rest of it. Versus, you know, back in the old days, you would channel surf and you'd be like, yep, nope, nope, yeah. Nope, nope. You know, click, 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 on and on and on. And it's, I feel like once you've rented something, you're somewhat kind of committed to it, even if you're like, and so that brings me to the third movie that I watched in the last, right. Which was this truly terrible movie called Hypnotic, which is charitably described by Wikipedia as a mystery action thriller. There's nothing mysterious about it. It has terrible action and it's not at all thrilling. So fail, fail, fail on all three of those. It's a Robert Rodriguez thing. He apparently co-wrote the absolutely risible screenplay with someone named Max Borenstein, who, I don't know, did Skull Island. Like, what the fuck? Anyway, this is such a bad movie. And I actually like Ben Affleck. I don't think he's a great actor, but I like him. You know, I just find him likable. Yeah. And sometimes he can be better than likable. So, like, I think he was quite good in the Nike movie that he directed.
I still have to see that one. Yeah.
I mean, it's not a I have to see movie. Okay. It's like one of these days, if it's on the back of an airplane seat, okay, or whatever, you're bored out of it. You know, I liked it. Mm-hmm. I gave it a fairly, you know, but like a lot of these other IP movies, it's a full length ad for Nike's. But I liked it, you know, and I was interested in how, I mean, we can talk about this soon with Barbie, about how Affleck, you know, who is very much a, shall we say, a prominent leftist, how he kind of deals with the inherent contradictions of this material, you know, by basically avoiding those contradictions or trying to, you know, kind of wiggle around them. So, but he's terrible in this movie. It's like watching some sort of Jack Snyder, like, you know, left on the cutting room floor, except that they're never really on the cutting room floor. They're in the delete box. Just terrible. And it's a nonsensical, some government agency or something or other creating people who are called hypnotics and they have this ability to hypnotize people. I mean, it's from Hunger. It's absolutely terrible. It's like Roger Corman would have, you know, laughed it out of his office once upon a time. You know, and so a lot of these kind of cheesy, not very good thriller, it is kind of like the stuff that would have just been pure exploitation, bottom of the shelf, the things that you kicked at the VHS, you'd accidentally trip over because they were on the bottom shelf at your local video store. right. And I would say this is not a committed performance at all by Ben Affleck, who seems my guess is that he was doing a favor to Rodriguez. Maybe he was killing time in between, you know, Superman duties or something. I don't know. I can't even like get it up to really kind of talk about the movie. It's just like, it's just so blah. Yeah. And it's got some people I really like, you know, some, you know, kind of very solid kind of B-movie actors that I like Jeff Fahey, William Finkner, Jackie Earle Haley, you know, so it's got some solid folks. Alice Braga is in there, seems to be trying to be very sincere in this otherwise ridiculous movie.
Wait, so
I mean, it's just terrible.
What brought you to Hypnotic then?
I don't know. Well, because I try to watch as much as possible. Mm-hmm, let's just say that, you know, and I do try to watch in a given year. I try to watch, you know, this is obviously not a major movie by any means, but it has a kind of, you know, has a movie star in it. Robert Rodriguez is a name director. Mm-hmm. It, you know, is Relativity, its brand is on it. So it's, you know, it's not just a nothing thing, you know. So, and I think it's really important to see as much stuff as possible. So, you know, I mean, I think the three movies I watch kind of are evidence of like, I'm just basically watching most everything,
yeah.
You know, with some exceptions, but I have very Catholic tastes, you know, I like a lot of stuff. But I also just want to see what's happening. And so I thought that this was abysmal. And
okay. Well, I will not watch.
It was out South by Southwest, which, oh, really? You know, yeah, yeah, there's a reason I don't go to South by Southwest.
Yeah. I've never been there. No, I had the same impulse with Megan.
Megan, I enjoyed.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. I thought that was very well done, and I thought it was a good Blumhouse production. You know.
Oh yeah.
Because he has his burn rate is like there's a lot of shit that he puts out, but this one was quite clever.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if he's an inheritor to Corman in a way, in terms of just like betting on a lot of things in a way. I'm really glad. I wish I had seen it earlier.
Yeah, me too.
I would have liked to write about it. But I thought it was actually also pretty smart about the emotional side of AI.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Having this child character who is basically just ends up being sort of emotionally stunted because of her reliance on AI, I thought was pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And maybe not, you know, I mean, maybe also just kind of a fear many people have, just even with whatever screen time or iPhone usage or iPad usage for kids or something.
Yeah, no, it's like we walk around, my husband and I we basically take a walk in the morning, usually around in our neighborhood. And I'm always dismayed when I see people pushing a stroller and their child is looking at a device and they're not talking to their kid. Their kid is just, the eyes are glued on the device. And it's just like, you know, you could look at animals and yeah, other people and engage in the world around you. That's really, so I thought, yeah, I thought it was a very, very clever. And then I kept thinking about Spielberg's AI, which I'm not a fan of, but I actually want to rewatch just because AI is just such headline news right now. And thinking about, you know, the creepy fake child as a kind of motif in movies is also really interesting, you know.
Oh, yeah. Strange. Yeah, it is odd. I actually, once I had to, someone asked me to do like a video essay about creepy kids in movies, and I was trying to find what Ground Zero was for that. And I don't know if I still think it, but I guess The Bad Seed was maybe one of the earliest.
I looked remarkably liked that character when I was a kid. It kind of flipped me out. I looked very much like the kid also on the illustration on the paperback, because I had bangs and extremely blonde, light hair. Okay. And it weirded me out. And of course, the story is so utterly creepy and strange. So, but it's that, you know, it's the kind of Children of the Corn and Children of the Damned, that kind of like the creepy little white supremacist, not like I was a white supremacist, now I've like worked myself into a horrible corner here, but you know, these kind of creepy little white kids, you know, they're just like, woo. But I think the AI is very creepy as well. And AI, you know, that's like, one of the things I also enjoyed about Megan was that I feel like Allison Williams has just found a really kind of hilarious little niche for herself as a, you know, I know she's been deemed a screen queen, though I don't think she really has enough credits to actually have that
to actually be crowned
that credit, but I just think there's just something about this character and her character in Get Out, which her character in Get Out is much more of a villain, obviously, but you know, she just seems like a completely self-involved, flighty person whose inattention causes great damage, you know. But it's funny that it's like she's perfectly cast this movie.
No, I agree. I mean, it really is like she's so good at just embodying, the unreflective person, you know.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great descriptor for it. Yeah,
because she's like a very talented programmer and like in this company, and that's also what I loved about it in terms of just like AI is people who are very smart but have not been thinking about the actual important stuff, important ramifications.
No, not at all.
And she is great for that.
Yes. Because they're so used to being the smartest person in the room that they actually don't think about the larger the room, the world outside the room, you know. So, which is really funny.
Yeah. Well, isn't it? Was there some quote? I forget who said it, but from like earlier in the 20th century, like the history of the world is like men making bad decisions in rooms or something like this. Or something. I forget how it goes.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Seems fair. Yeah.
That seems very fair.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Megan is one thing I caught up with. And I mean, yeah, the other thing I was just going to toss out is I've been watching for this piece about mushroom clouds, a lot of nuclear related movies. I mean, which put me honestly in a bit of a spiral, right?
Oh, I'm sure. It's very upsetting. It's a very upsetting thing. So,
because I guess kind of contemporary attention patterns are on other things right now, but all the nuke stuff still exists and still is like arguably even more volatile when you have like an currently invading and superpower threatening to use it for tactical reasons. But yeah, I mean, watching Black Rain, for example, the Imamura movie, which is,
is it any wonder that Barbie is the bigger movie, though? I have to say, it's just like no one wants to think about that. You know what I mean?
It's
putting aside the 3 hours or whatever, but it's just like everyone wants fun.
And the thing with Barbie is that, I mean, I guess this is obvious refrain, but like, why is it such a surprise when, you know, a movie that attracts, again, like a lot of women audiences is really successful? Then it's like, oh my God, what a surprise.
Because it's always a surprise, Nick, and it will never not be a surprise as long as we're still having the same configuration of who actually has power. This is always about power, right? Yeah. And so it's always a surprise. I mean, I read something the other day, even though I was trying to avoid movie stuff, which was, I was just that something popped into my email and I read the email. It was just about other companies really hating this movie, you know, and I was thinking, well, I'm sure that some of that hatred is to do with women audiences and a woman director. I'm absolutely positive, you know, and I'm not a huge fan of this movie. You know, I enjoyed it up until a certain point, but it is also, it's another one of these IP movies and it's a feature length ad. Mm-hmm. And there's no escaping that. And she cannot figure her way out of that. You know, it's just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And my whole feeling though is like, I just want people to go to the movies. You know, I want everyone to go to the movies. I want theatrical to rebound. And particularly right now, I ran into somebody who works in the entertainment industry last night and I asked her if she was worried. She said she's very, very worried. You know, I mean, obviously she's not working right now because most of her clients are out on strike. But, you know, it's like how badly are these people running the business, how badly are they going to fuck things up? They've already fucked things up really badly. How much worse can it be? You know, I was hoping completely irrationally, nonsensically perhaps, that the good box office for both Barbie and Oppenheimer would mean that, you know, the people running this business who are holding out would kind of remember that, gee whiz, we can make a lot of money and move with movies opening in theaters, and maybe we should get these people off the picket line and back to work, you know?
Yeah.
I was hoping just their sheer greed would win out, but that was silly of me.
I don't know. It's this combination of like the winner take all kind of, there's just always like an entitlement already. So it's like, yeah, we'll take this huge amount of money, but we still want to do what we wanted to do, even if it's contrary to what these movies are demonstrating.
Yeah.
It has given me, you know, cause to sort of think about Barbie a bit more just because it is being seen. I mean, it's the sort of thing where I think more so than some other big movies, when a movie like that is seen by a lot of people, maybe it changes a little somehow. I mean, it's still the movie it was, but like, for example, I have not seen the Super Mario Brothers movie.
I have not.
But that is apparently the highest grossing movie of this year.
Well, and it apparently did very well. You know, I had no interest in seeing it, but I'll see it eventually. There will be something I'm sure I'll watch on a plane at some point. You know, and I've watched fine movies on planes.
So. Yeah. But I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, maybe that movie also has subversive elements in it, but I don't know if it.
Yeah, but subversive is a word that should be put locked in a box and put away in the attic. It's just, it is one of the most wrongly, stupidly used words in, again, film, quote unquote, discourse. And I just can't bear it. Because really, what in the fuck is subversive about a movie made by Mattel and Warner Brothers and released by Warner Brothers? What, really? There's nothing. Zero. Not a single thing is subversive. Not a single thing. I will die on this hill. I'm just, well, you know, it's just laughable to me. I'm glad people are seeing it. I want people to go to the movies. I'm glad that I liked it as much as I did. I'm happy for Greta Gerwig, who I think is incredibly talented. I really like Margot Robbie. Again, I gave it one of those reviews where I'm working hard to say she's very talented. I enjoyed it, you know, and then I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't quite, you know. So it, you know, it was not in by any means a negative review, but I wasn't, you know, it was fine. You know, I liked it. I thought it was amusing. I think it's kind of strange how certain things are kind of strange about it, but not in the, you know, I wanted it to be subversive, but I just, it makes me insane.
Yeah.
It just makes
Well, for the sake of argument, what is there a movie that comes to mind that approaches being subversive that was a studio movie like that?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't know. Maybe Hoberman could make an argument for the last movie, you know, Dennis Hopper's movie, but I just can't think of a single right now. I just don't think that Hollywood studio and subversive belong in the same sentence. I just don't. And I'm sure people can, you know, come up with lots of examples, but I just, subverting what?
Mm-hmm.
Subverting what, you know?
Right.
I mean, what are they subverting?
Yeah.
I mean, so far, I'm pretty sure the revolution has not happened because some movie opened up and it had a bad or bummer ending or said capitalism sucks even as it was raking in the dough. So what in the world are they subverting?
No, I mean, for me, it was like a classic example of a movie of commodifying the revolution, you know.
It's got this one line, you know, it's one of these movies that I just thought, like, let's whip out our postmodern books, right? It's got this one line where a young woman complains to Barbie that she's just advancing consumer culture. So the movie can have that one little moment, right? This one line in a movie that is otherwise, you know, but what that is expressing is completely canceled out by the other, you know, 2 hours of the movie. So it's just like, it's nonsense. It's a kind of gesture towards an idea that, you know, it in no way embraces and has no interest in embracing and could never actualize in any way possible. It just can't. Mm-hmm. It is impossible. Mm-hmm. It is the very thing that it is pretending to critique. And that's fine. I don't go to the movies, you know, to get my revolutionary like game on, you know. I mean, that's absurd. So I just find like there's certain terms that people are very, very fond of using. Brechtian, again, not a term, like, really? And what do you mean by that? You know, there are just certain terms that are kind of, they become very easy shorthand, you know, and it's like when I was in graduate school, the several times I've gone to graduate school, it's like you just read them and you're like, oh, okay, these are, you know, and then we embrace, but they're kind of template words, you know, it's an idea, a fixed idea that you had, and then you just kind of put it on the material mm-hmm. versus actually working through what you're actually seeing on screen.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I'll end my rant there, but it drives me crazy.
No, it's true. Well, it's also, I think some of these words have become, it's not as if marketers are unaware of the appeal or of those words, I think, you know, like subversive or whatever. Yeah. So it becomes sure. part of the pitch almost, you know.
But, you know, subversive, fun, what's the diff, Nick?
I'll take my fun subversive, please. Yeah, it's part of me is considering seeing it again. I don't know why, but.
Well, we'll enjoy.
That's right. And I've also been watching Usman Sembin movies.
Ah, uh-huh.
And so the connection there being the idea of like a political cinema.
Right. But is political the same as subversive?
No, not at all. No, but
right,
yeah.
Right.
But just that idea of what it might look like. Like I watched Black Girl, which I haven't seen in a number mm-hmm. of years. And it just like mm-hmm. blew me away all over again.
Absolutely.
You know?
Totally masterpiece. Absolutely.
So it's what I'm saying is like people try really hard to make other movies fit the bill of having that kind of impact.
Right.
But
right.
Sometimes it helps, at least helps me at least to go back and see a movie that is actually doing the thing.
yeah. And there's only one Sembin, you know what yeah. I mean? Like that's a really amazing movie and really important. Yeah. But you know, I think incredibly important movie. And yeah. I, you know, it was on my sight and sound list actually. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll wrap up our weird and wonderful tour of movies there.
Okay. Kind of like whatever I just happened to glance on, you know?
Yeah. Glad we could talk about these. And
oh, it's great.
I guess we'll probably cross paths at another festival in the future.
I bet we will. So I look forward to seeing you. And thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.